last year we launched our first wedding collection. I never thought I was going to do that. But a lot of it was just a very kind of organic feedback. 2 years before that, we launched kind of metal printing collection. One of my necklaces was acquired by the LA County Museum of Art. Things started to happen, and we kind of just listened to what people were looking for and how to think about this kind of architecture on the body.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Designed, an architecture podcast. We appreciate you listening, and once you're finished, please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast, rate us, and leave a comment. Enjoy the show, and have a wonderful day.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Designed with me, your host, Aaron Prinz. As always, I just want to say thank you to all of you for out there for listening to the podcast, subscribing to it. All the comments on the iTunes review section, thank you so much. I really appreciate it, and keep them coming. As always, be sure to follow us on Instagram at designed.podcast so you stay up to date with everything we have going on. We have KPF, Kengo Kuma, Shop, so many great firms coming, and I just don't want you to miss anything. This week's episode was pretty awesome. It was Jenny Wu of Euler Wu and Lace by Jenny Wu. She does so many things. She has an architecture firm. She teaches at SciArc. She has a really successful jewelry line, and we get into all of it in the podcast. So there's really just a lot to take away from this one because we go in a bunch of different directions, but it's just a really great conversation. So hope you enjoy it. Sit back, relax. Here we go with Jenny Wu.
You really do everything. You have an architecture firm, a very successful jewelry line. You teach. I'm assuming you do everything but sleep. Your firm really, it says it focuses on experimental architecture. And I think kind of if you look at like the deconstructivist, and there's a lot of students and young architects out there that are trying to do this type of work, but maybe they aren't doing it as well as some. So can you take us through really what makes your designs so successful? So what allows your projects to also be built?
So when my partner Dwayne and I first started, it was definitely one of those moments when we had just moved from New York to LA, and you know, we said we're gonna start our own firm. We had no clients, we knew no one. And when you're kind of starting out, you think about how do you build a body of work. And I think at that time, you know, we had done previously something like 4 or 5 different competitions, and we felt like that format was really something we weren't super into, because we thought we were just kind of doing one, you know, not getting very in depth with the project. So we thought, with especially Dwayne's background in fabrication and our eagerness to make work, you know, our first project was a loft in the American Cement Building, which we built using a month of rent, which was at that time around $2,500, but obviously a ton of labor in building it. It got published. Then the next one we did my parents' back patio, then built it, and then got published. And we're like, oh, we're kind of good at this. And so then, but of course, then we ran out of clients, because then you do one for yourself, and then you do one for your parents, and then you're done. And at that time, we thought, well, this way of doing kind of design and fabrication was a way for us to build work. So like a lot of young architects, they may approach the more kind of competition-based work trying to get a big project. But for us, we thought about just kind of building it up slowly and through these installations that we design and build ourselves. So for the next, well, up to now, which is over 10 years now, but especially in the beginning, I mean, we're doing a lot bigger projects now, but in the beginning, we were doing at least one, sometimes up to 3 installations a year. And just realizing after doing the first few that the process has made us even a much better designer, because understanding ideas of assembly and material and really thinking about how far can I push this has helped us, yeah, do things better. And then we also realized that the way we like to work isn't, you know, for every project trying one style here, another style there, but in fact building up a kind of experience of working on a problem, working through a material. And then when we feel like we're not learning or doing something new, then we move on to the next. So yeah, so that's kind of how we got started and how we got into what we do now. So
real quickly, we have a lot to talk about with your career, but real quickly, can you take our audience through kind of where you grew up, what your parents did, the economics of your household, and out of all the things you could have done in life, why the heck architecture?
So I grew up in Los Angeles in the suburbs, and my parents were developers, but right before we moved to LA, I was born in Taipei, and my family had done some development work there, and so I kind of grew up on a job site. So I thought I wanted to be an architect, even though I had no idea what that really meant. So I'm glad it worked out.
Yeah. And you went to school at Columbia, and then you went to school at Harvard afterwards. Did you work anywhere after Harvard?
Yes. So from after Harvard, we moved to New York. I was at ARO and Gluckman Mahner. So we were in New York for 4 years, and then we moved to LA. And then when I was in LA, I worked for a couple years at WHY.
So just to step back to the Columbia and Harvard, those are two really competitive schools. Can you kind of put us in that studio space? And what about that do you think that has led to the work that you're doing now?
They're very, very different. I was at Columbia during the late 90s when it was the start of the paperless studio in the GSAP. But I was an undergrad, so I wasn't able to really participate, but seeing it kind of sort of in the next door building, but going to all the kind of reviews and events. And that was super inspiring and understanding like kind of the possibility of the digital age, which in some ways is sort of funny now to think about it. We were using these kind of Unix machines and using sort of very first generation animation softwares as we were learning. And I think at that time, just it was such an interesting convergence of practitioners, Greg Lynn, like just all these interesting people that were teaching there, and Neil, and although I didn't have any of them, but just seeing them like there was super inspiring. And after I graduated undergrad at Columbia, then I went to the GSD, which was a completely different environment. I think it took a bit of adjustment, but you know, GSD is just it was an amazing place to really meet incredible people and also practitioners, you know, having Rem and Herzog and all these people teaching there. And that's also where I met my partner. So
you mentioned the technology and the paperless studio and this sort of thing. I had a conversation with Patrick Schumacher about 4 or 5 months ago, and as well as with Chris Sharpless. Who did you go to Columbia with him? Were you there at the same time?
He was there, but he was in the grad school.
And we were talking about architects being marginalized by technology. And SciArc is a school that really focuses on the technological aspect of things. And I just saw Tom Main talk, and he was showing these 100 building forms that he pretty much pressed a button and it kicked out 100 forms. And from there, they developed their design and everything like that. And I think a lot of students say, wow, that's really cool. And I'm saying, it's also kind of scary. How do you see this role of technology and automation really playing a factor in the future of architecture? And do you think it is going to be a point where the architect is irrelevant?
Well, just to answer the last question first, I don't think the role of the architect or architecture in general will be obsolete. I think I'm teaching a studio now where we're really incorporating a lot of technology in the actual studio project and, you know, working with AI. And I do think that at the end of the day, there's someone putting in the inputs to get the output and to then evaluate the output as you understand and how to re-input it. So there is a kind of a curation and a perspective that comes out of at least so far the step of where AI is. So personally, I find it really interesting to kind of using this kind of, you know, obviously there will be results. It's unexpected. But at the same time, there are things that you can control to do more of those unexpected moments. So I find that that's what's been really rewarding about teaching at SciArc is over the last 13 years and seeing in terms of even just the software has evolved, what we teach has evolved. And it's also a place where, you know, I rarely teach the same studio twice, and we're constantly thinking about, you know, how to introduce new ideas, new technology into the project.
Well, how does the teaching at SciArc, so your firm does research, then you do research at SciArc, and there's a sort of this loop, I would imagine. So how does your work influence your teaching at SciArc, and then how does teaching at SciArc come back and influence the work of Euler Wu?
I think more than any other school, I find the teaching at SciArc is a very reciprocal relationship. And I think, especially in our earlier work, where we were actually doing work at SciArc, like building physical installations for like graduation pavilions and things like that. We don't do much of that now, but I think SciArc believes in finding faculty that is teaching their expertise. So, but you have to have an expertise to teach there and what you're working on. So one, it forces you to not just be a teacher, but also a practitioner and really work on what it is that you care about and you're interested and you're good at, and then how to then take that and teach it to your student. And I think that's super important at SciArc. And at the same time, there's that kind of impetus to building your practice because you want to also be able to give back to school. And then at the same time, this, I think just working with students all the time, it gives you new ideas, keeps you fresh and thinking about how to keep evolving your own work.
You mentioned earlier the couple firms you worked at after grad school. Can you take us through that moment? Because I could imagine it's pretty daunting to kind of step away from a guaranteed paycheck to start your own firm. So can you take us through kind of what that process was for you and Dwayne? And then was there a moment when you guys kind of were like, hey, we made it?
No. I think, definitely that moment where you thought, okay, how do we just become totally independent? Just when we first moved from New York to LA, Dwayne actually never got a full-time job. So he was teaching as full-time and then sort of full-time on our practice. And then I was the one, because we knew nothing about LA and we wanted to build some kind of knowledge about consultants to work with, how to deal with the city and all that stuff. So I worked for someone and project managed some projects and building some knowledge that was different than what I knew from New York. And then there was a point when we were starting to do more and more of these installations, and we just realized that we need to focus. And so I left my job and then joined Dwayne. And then also at that time, I also got a teaching job as a way to supplement. As you can imagine, that installations don't really make money in the beginning. So,
well, I think there's also something, I was, you know, flipping through your website and everything, and there's an extremely, and this might be a SciArc thing, I don't know, but there's a huge amount of production value in everything you do, whether it's from your Instagram page to your website, the videos on your website, the photography. How do you think that production value really fits into the success of the firm? I mean, is that something you have even thought about? I mean,
we're very conscious of, you know, there are things that you don't even see. Like, we make a project book after every project, and we just had a show in Taipei, and they were just stunned at like how generally organized our like archiving and all of our projects were. I think we just feel like we consciously work on that. Everything from the photography, every rendering, to these kind of project books and models. We're big on always completing a thought. So we don't really have that sketchy models. Every model looks like it's totally done, even if it's a study model. Because we really believe in that. And we teach that to our students. And we just really believe that even if it's not quite right, if you finish designing and finish building it, then you're going to discover more things that you don't know. And then so that the next time, because a lot of people sometimes, like, they do a corner of their project and then they realize, oh, you know, I'm done. And then I hate this. And then move on. And then we always think like complete your massing all the way through, like, just so you discover something about maybe something else somewhere else that might be back to that corner that you really were obsessing over. So everything does, we always complete the work at the highest level, which also at the same time, like our installations, you know, we always value the fact that we try to make our installations better than the original renderings. And I think that's where we really get down to the small details and how we build these, finish these. So I think it's just part of the culture.
You mentioned that the firm doesn't like to participate in competitions. So this is one of my favorite questions that I ask multiple firms throughout the podcast. But so you're shortlisted for a project. You go into the final meeting. What is it that makes the client say, hey, we're going to go with Oil or Woo?
I think we're very good in bringing a client into our process. And I really think this process that I was describing before about thinking through these problems and really this massive iterative process that we work on to go from the beginning to the end of design. And then also through just like really working on letting our clients understand how we think about a problem. I mean, when we were doing a lot of these, we've been recently working on a lot of projects with the city of LA, and you present to these communities that really don't know anything about architecture. And I think it has helped us really think through, like, how do I talk about this like a normal person and not just only archy speak, you know? And I think that has also helped us a lot.
So I want to get to Lace by Ginny Wu. GinnyWooLace.com. You've built a really, in 5 years, a really successful jewelry design business. Could you kind of take us through where did the idea come from and kind of what sets your jewelry apart?
To be transparent, I never thought about starting a jewelry brand. And about 6 years ago now, had some ideas about these necklaces that sort of became extension of my overall outfit. And then, you know, I had these ideas, but I knew nothing about jewelry. And that was when I was starting to go to a lot of talks. And I thought it would be great to, you know, have something that felt like my own. And I didn't see things out there. So we started working on some pieces. And then we just like, well, I don't know anything about how to produce this. But, you know, we know how to 3D print. So we printed and I started wearing it. And people started to want to buy it. You make one for a friend and make another one. And then I was like, I remember one weekend I was at Art Basel in Miami and I was walking down the street and people kept coming up to me. They're like, what is that? How to buy it? You know? And so at that point we thought, okay, maybe I have something there. So for the next year, I spent just trying to work with different 3D printing companies, trying to figure out how to actually use 3D printing to translate the design and into a real product. Then I launched in fall of 2014. But even over the last 5 years we've been doing this, the brand has evolved so much. Like, you know, last year we launched our first wedding collection. I never thought I was going to do that. But a lot of it was just a very kind of organic feedback. 2 years before that, we launched kind of metal printing collection. One of my necklaces was acquired by the LA County Museum of Art. Things started to happen and we kind of just listened to what people were looking for and how to think about this kind of architecture on the body differently than what's out there in the world of jewelry. And I think that's also what is making it resonate with people. And I think now we're starting to hopefully not just a niche brand for designers, but to move into the more mainstream, because even I think people mainstream sees the work, they seem to really love it.
Now that you have kind of two companies going, how do you kind of merge the two?
I feel like 100% Oil or Woo, 100% jewelry, 100% Sci-Arc, and I have two kids. so yeah, I mean, I think what's great is that we were able to figure out how to combine our Oil or Woo and Lace staff together in one space, and we help each other out if one needs a little more help. And also we're finally at a point where we can have full-time staff for Lace as well, which is amazing. But also thinking through the process, not like a normal company, but thinking through like an architect thinking about how to solve a problem in a creative way. And so how do we combine these different things in a productive way that you know, sometimes when one thing is a little bit slow, we can move people over to help on other things. It feeds off each other. And we're now even seeing that lace clients finding our architecture instead of the other way around, which is crazy.
What's your proudest moment in architecture?
I feel like it's like every time we build something, you go there, you're like, this is the best thing we ever done. And then it happens again, like the next project you do it, you know? But I guess the last project we completed, I mean, the major project we completed in Taipei, which is a big tower, that was a really big moment for us because, you know, it really, about 3-4 years ago, we started to move from the installation work into bigger projects. And that was such a big move for us because we also, like, when you only work on small things, you have to rethink how you jump scale from one type of project into another. And you can't just, like, make a pipe bigger, you know, to fit a big building. So really thinking through those and really start to work on that kind of problem was really exciting. And I think that's also part of the things that's happening now is we're getting different genre of building work. And then I think that's where we're really getting to learn and try new things. It's been super fun. But the I think that Taipei, when it opened, I remember we weren't there, but they had just actually taken the scaffolding down, and this kind of sculptural quality of the facade was quite incredible. And like, I kept getting these like texts in the middle of the night from Taipei, like, we see it now, we see it now. And then being able to see it a few months later in person was like amazing.
The jump in scale you talked about earlier, what were some of the issues you had and what were kind of some of the solutions you had to kind of take what you've done on the smaller scale and implement it successfully into the larger project?
Yeah, I think when we first started, we were very interested in sort of line-based geometries, and we worked with a lot of lines and bundling of lines and how we start to assemble into bigger things. And as we moved on, we realized that, you know, we're working out a much more robust set of problems, and lines can't solve all of it, but we need to have an idea. So I think a lot of it is also moving from just a purely line base to start to think about how to create a kind of relationship between line, surface, and volume. And then also thinking about like scale of pieces that you can't just blow up a line that was one pipe. And then when it's on a 20-story building, that pipe would just get huge. How to rethink, you know, what a line is on a surface. It may become more of a kind of layering of material and taking more pieces to build up that line. And so I think a lot of it is just thinking through that and also thinking through very practical things like how to keep water out, you know, how to do something that is both experimental, but then also is functional and works like a real building. So I think there was just a lot of learning process in between that.
What's your biggest setback in architecture, and how did you use that to motivate your career to get to where you are today?
I would say, like, before we started our office, and I have mentioned we did a lot of competitions, and I remember the very first competition Duane and I did, and it was actually quite a big one, and we won, like, third place or something, and we were like, oh, this is easy, like, we could do this, and then we did, like, 6 or 7 after that, never placed again. And we thought, okay, this is not easy. But then we realized, thinking through that problem, is why are we not winning, or why is this process right for us? And we just felt like it was not us thinking through the problem from the design to all the way to the real thing was something that we thought really just making real projects would be more worthwhile. And so that's where we dropped the whole competition thing and start making up our own projects.
What advice would you have for the young architect that wants to have the type of career that you've had?
I think you just have to, like, I always say that a lot of times students say, oh, I'm going to make some money and then I'll work in a big kind of office that may not have the same kind of design ambition. And then they then were like, oh, I'm just going to work and make some money and then I'll then do my thing. But, you know, 10 years later, they become, you know, important person in that big company, but they're very unhappy. And so because they just get comfortable and they can't transition. And so I do feel like you have to really think about what kind of architect you would like to be. And then figure out what are the steps to get there. And if it means that you work on small things and you might not make a lot of money, but it's going to get better and better. And so, and then also even once you start to build your career, like we don't have two portfolios, like one for things that we want to do and then one for things that pays the bills. Like we just do one thing and we just try to do it well. And hopefully by at some point, the things that we do well will start to make money, which we're happy to be at that point now.
Last question. What's next for Euler Woo and Lace?
So with Euler Woo, we're working on a new tower in Taipei. We have some projects in the pipeline that are, we're working on a new, also another ground up building, a new work co-working space in LA. We're doing a lot more infrastructure with the city of LA. We have now four projects there. And other interesting types of project lingering elsewhere in the world that hopefully will happen soon. And with Lace, we're starting to kind of build the wedding collection a little bit more. And now also just, as I mentioned, transition from a kind of niche brand into a mainstream brand, just starting to work on what that means and how to still maintain our design integrity and all the things we care about, and but also continue to build the collection. So, and then always experimenting with different 3D printing technologies, new ones that might give us different results. So it's always also an experiment at Lace as well.
Awesome. Well, Jenny Wu, I really appreciate you taking the time to sit down and talk with me. I really enjoyed it. I hope you did as well. And thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Enjoy, everybody.
Thank you for listening to an episode of Designed, an architecture podcast. We'd appreciate you taking a moment to subscribe to us, rate us, and leave us a comment. Have a wonderful day.